From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in what's being called an unprecedented move for a president-elect, Donald Trump began his thank you tour in Cincinnati last night, thanking his supporters. He spoke about building an inclusive society, but also a wall. He condemned bigotry and the media, and in what felt like a break with the tradition, dissed the loser in the race.
I'm going to discuss our action plan to make America great again. We're going to discuss it. Although we did have a lot of fun fighting Hillary, didn't we? Yeah. Right?
Trump supporters yelling, "Lock her up."
Well, raw emotions about the election were also on display yesterday when Trump and Clinton campaign leaders met at a forum at Harvard University. Here's an exchange between Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway and Clinton communications director Jennifer Palmieri, who accused the Trump campaign of providing a platform for white supremacists.
I would rather lose than win the way you guys did.
No, you wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't.
Yes. No, you wouldn't.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
No, that's very clear today. No, you wouldn't, respectfully.
No.
Rather, I'm sorry. How exactly did we win? No, go for it, Jen. How exactly did we win? I'd like to know, because I've sacrificed the last 4 months of my life to do it. Excuse me.
Time for our Friday roundtable with Jesse Holland, who covers politics for the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
And Julie Mason is with us, who hosts the Press Pool on Sirius XM. Hi, Julie.
Greetings.
And what about that moment last night with Kellyanne Conway and Jennifer Palmieri, Julie?
Boy, we are a long way from being unified. What was so extraordinary about that was that here in D.C., we're so used to these pros being really unemotional, even when they lose. I mean, this is their work, and they don't publicly express these kinds of strong feelings about it. But for the Clinton team, losing to Donald Trump was not like losing to Mitt Romney or to John McCain, because they do believe deeply that he is unqualified to be president. So it's not just losing. It's losing and being bewildered by the results in a way that we've never seen before.
Well, Jesse Holland, also what we didn't hear in that sound was that Jennifer Palmieri, the Clinton operative, did say that the Trump campaign became, you know, used platforms for white supremacists. I mean, she threw that gauntlet down, and this forum happens every 4 years. I've never heard that kind of an exchange.
Yeah, it seems like the old rules are gone for everything, not only for the presidential election, but including how politicals are going to treat each other after the presidential election. It seems like
Do you think it was fair, a fair accusation? Because Steve Bannon, who's now Donald Trump's chief strategist, did say that his former news agency, Breitbart News, was a platform for the alt-right.
Well, I mean, obviously that the Clinton people think it's a valid argument, and we've seen the embrace of the Trump campaign by a lot of white nationalist groups, including David Duke. So that's not a big stretch to make, to say that white supremacists were on board with what the Trump campaign was saying. But normally after an election, people sort of let things go. At least the professional people let things go. It doesn't sound like that's happening this time.
Yeah, right.
What do you make, Julie, of what's going on with Trump's cabinet? He's named a few people this week: Steven Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary, Wilbur Ross as Commerce Secretary, two Wall Street guys with a lot of money, and also recently retired General James Mattis as Defense Secretary, somebody who has a military background, which is going to need a waiver from Congress because typically we have civilians at the top of the Pentagon.
Right. Mad Dog Mattis.
Yeah.
Washington is in stitches. Everybody loves that guy. Very colorful. Can't wait to see. Here's the thing about these cabinet picks, though, is I'm refusing to get emotionally involved until they get confirmed. Because if history has taught us anything, is that these candidates or these presidents-elect make a big splash with their cabinet picks and something always goes wrong.
You think something's going to go wrong with one of these?
Yes. Yes. Not because there's anything inherently wrong with them, but look at Tom Daschle. Right. He was a slam dunk and he didn't make the cabinet. So you just never know. It's going to be a tax problem or some nanny with an immigration problem or something like that. Something always comes up. But I have to say, the establishment is feeling reassured. A lot hinges on who he picks for State Department.
Oh, yeah. And what about that? I mean, this has just become such an awkward beauty pageant.
I would hate to see the swimsuit competition.
Yeah. Well,
they've already gone through the frog leg eating contest.
Yes, right. Jesse, weigh in on that.
Well, you know, it's going to look bad for everyone he doesn't pick for that position. He's sort of parading these people around the public as saying, oh, look at this. Here's Mr. New Jersey. Now Mr. New York. I mean, it's going to be extremely embarrassing for the people he doesn't pick now that they've been put out in the public and he's been parading them around like they're beauty pageant contestants.
Well, let's listen.
So we've never seen anything like this before.
Let's listen to the contestant from Utah, Mitt Romney, after dining with Donald Trump. Jeremy mentioned the frog legs this week.
He did something I tried to do and was unsuccessful in accomplishing. He won the general election. And he continues with a message of inclusion and bringing people together. And his vision is something which obviously connected with the American people in a very powerful way.
Well, Julie, this is particularly head-spinning because Mitt Romney had been such a vocal critic of Donald Trump. And, you know, there's still speculation that this is all about setting up Mitt Romney for some sort of payback.
It's really hard to figure this one out because obviously Mitt Romney doesn't need the work, right? And he also doesn't need the hassle. A lot is made about his zeal for public service and how that, you know, that could be fueling a lot of this. But it's hard to understand why, why someone with his credentials, his background and his long service in public life would want to take on this kind of a problem.
Jesse, what do you make of this recount situation? Because it's ongoing. It hasn't started in some places, but Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where the numbers are pretty close, but probably a little too far apart for a recount to change things, or at least that's the expectation. But the Trump team is trying to stop at least some of these recounts from happening. Why are they so worried?
Well, I mean, no one wants to take a chance that something untoward has happened with them. No one actually wants to believe what then-candidate Trump said, that the election could be rigged, and find out, whoops, maybe there was a mistake. Maybe there were votes that weren't counted. The Trump campaign doesn't want that. But it's highly unlikely that any recount is going to change anything that we know about the election so far, that Trump got the most electoral college votes, Clinton got the most in the popular vote. Nothing's going to change that. But maybe this will provide some catharsis for some Democrats and independent party voters who still don't want to believe that President-elect Trump won. Maybe this is something that'll make them feel better once they see every vote has been counted and Trump still won the electoral college vote.
Yeah. I want to ask you both about the conflicts of interest and Trump's business holdings. And now, as Jeremy mentioned, he's got one of the wealthiest cabinet, at least in nominations, ever in American history. These calls for people to divest of their business because of conflict of interest. The Boston Globe had an interesting piece today about a soon-to-expire visa program that provides a green card to wealthy foreign investors, many of them from China. So, for instance, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has used this to finance some of the real estate he's developing. Literally, if someone from China invests $500,000 in a Trump building, which they are, they get a green card. That is selling green cards. And it is in direct opposition to Trump's language on the campaign trail about limiting the people who come to this country.
Yeah, he's supposedly having a press conference on December 15 to detail how he's going to take himself completely out of his own business to focus on running the country. But there are no details on that as yet. And part of the problem is who's going to provide oversight of this incoming president and his cabinet? Republicans in Congress? I don't think so. It's going to be left to the press to do it. And, you know, you heard him last night talking about the dishonest media. He's done his best. Both of the candidates have done their best to discredit the news media. So who are you going to call?
Andrew Ross Sorkin in The Times has actually written an open letter to Trump suggesting a corporate monitors. You know, these are independent people who know everything that's going on in your company.
But why would a president-elect Trump do that?
Yeah.
When he's going to pay for that.
When he now can, he can actually keep going exactly the way he is. And who's going, like Julie said, who the Republicans in Congress are going to provide the oversight? Why would he do something like that? Now, one of the things we have to keep in mind, and we've seen this repeatedly, and this has been also said repeatedly, during the campaign, the press took Trump seriously but not literally. I mean, the press took Trump literally but not seriously, but his campaigners, the people who voted for him, took him seriously but not literally. all of the campaign promises he made, he's shown that he's flexible on pretty much all of them. So why would we then agree to take him seriously when he says, you know, I'm going to divest myself of my business interests? He can do it if he wants to, but if he decides not to, who's going to provide the oversight of it?
Let me put you both on the spot for just a second here. We don't know what's coming next week in terms of Secretary of State, but your guess, Julie, who's it going to be?
Oh, for Secretary of State?
Yeah.
Corker.
Corker and Jesse?
I actually have to agree with her. I think Bob Corker.
I hear there's a lot of groundswell on Capitol Hill for that choice.
Las Vegas is listening in.
Are they betting on this? Jesse Holland, who covers politics for the Associated Press, and Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on Sirius XM. Great to have you both, as always. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
1 year ago today, the city of San Bernardino, California, experienced a tragedy. During an end-of-the-year party at the Inland Regional Center, Syed Rizwan Farouk and Tashfeen Malik opened fire, killing 14 people and wounding 22 others. The FBI concluded that they were homegrown violent extremists inspired by foreign terror groups. In June, we traveled to San Bernardino and met Julie Paez. She was shot twice during the attack. She's a mother of three and was one of the people who helped organize the party. So you were in that room?
We were in the room. I was on the setup committee, so I was there a little early. We had a kind of a little schedule where we would take breaks. And during the breaks, we had each of the kind of groups of people would take pictures together for kind of an annual, just a group shot with the people you work directly with.
Hmm. So just kind of a normal day.
It's pretty much a normal day, yeah. Everything was fine as far as I knew. I didn't, you know, there were reports that Syed had gotten arguments with people. There was nothing that I noticed out of the ordinary that day.
But you knew him?
I knew him, yeah. I never worked directly with him. Hmm. I wouldn't consider him a friend, although he was friendly.
Farouk had attended the party in the morning, but left at about 10:30 a.m. A half an hour later, he and his wife returned with semi-automatic rifles and pistols and began to open fire.
I at first thought this was some kind of drill, but being on the planning committee, I was like, we didn't plan for any kind of drill. So it was kind of like sinking. But that was my first moments. When things were actually flying around, that I realized this isn't, you know, fake gun sounds. This is real. But I was down by then. I never got up. I was shot when I was down.
And what did you do when you realized it was real?
When I realized it was real, I tried the best I could to just, get as prone on the ground as possible, kind of make myself as, you know, against the ground. And I honestly did sort of, I don't want to say play dead, but almost like you just don't move.
Did you recognize him when he walked in?
When he walked in shooting? Mm-hmm. No.
Did you realize that you had been shot? Because I often hear people that get shot and they don't even realize it, but you knew.
No, I knew I was shot because I was shot right in the right through the pubic bone. I felt blood and urine spill out, so I knew exactly where I was shot. So, no, I felt myself shot both times. The second time, basically the same area. Part of me was thinking, well, at least it didn't damage a whole other area of my body.
Outside the room, there was chaos. The building was evacuated, and first responders were on their way. Local TV journalist Alex Vasquez of KNBC was the first reporter on the scene.
Well, that specific day, I was on my way to my office, and I heard on the police scanner a call of a reported shooting. And I was only maybe, three blocks away. So I came around and I saw two officers with their lights and sirens heading towards the IRC building. I parked my news van, I grabbed my camera, and when I grabbed the camera was when I heard a loud bam. So I'm thinking the whole time, this is a drill, this isn't real. I drive up and down the street all the time. And I parked the van, I grabbed the camera, started running towards the building. Right here on the corner is when I saw people running towards me. Screaming, yelling, there's a shooter, there's a gunman. And some of the images that I remember mostly is a pickup truck actually driving away from the building with about six or seven gunshot victims in the bed of the truck, and they were bleeding profusely. I mean, it was a very, very bloody scene.
And you're saying that the space where we're standing right now, right across the street, was actually a place that the authorities set up to...
This was the triage center right here. And I remember specifically walking across this little crosswalk here, and seeing a woman laying there, and I was going to put the microphone in her face to interview her because I had my camera, and I went across to interview her other friend. She waved me off, said, I don't want to talk, I've been shot. By the time I turned around, that woman had taken her last breath, and she had actually passed away right there in front of me. So it was something that was an image that I'll never get out of my head. So when I can, I try to stay away from this area. Even coming today, I felt weird parking over there because it brings back those memories of that day and what I saw. It was weird because as a journalist, you know this, we have a job to do and to report. But that day, I couldn't help but put my camera down and lend people my cell phone so you can call their loved ones and tell them that they were okay. Because everybody was running and from that building to where we're standing right here.
Meanwhile, the shooters were nowhere to be found. Hundreds of officers and agents had arrived at the site of the attack, including Sergeant Gary Shulkey, a narcotics officer in the city whose son Ryan is also on the force.
And at this point, you think that it's terrorism or a workplace shooting, or you just don't know?
Really had no idea. Given the fact that it was a county employee, it was a county building, I was kind of thinking maybe workplace related. Mm-hmm. Wasn't really thinking towards the terrorist angle, but didn't really have any idea. And then a call of a suspicious vehicle came in at one of our local parks here. And during the information gathered from the reporting party on that call was a black SUV with Utah plates, and we actually got the plate number. Donnie ran up the license plate, found that it was a rental car company.
He's referring to police analyst Donnie Svonkin, who worked on the investigation.
Through her many contacts, she was able to track down who rented that vehicle, and it turns out it was, in fact, Syed Farouk. I asked her to find the rental agreement. From that rental agreement, we got some information. In the meantime, Donnie also found an address in our databases. We have special law enforcement databases that we use, and she found an address in Redlands.
And once you got there?
Immediately when they got there, the black SUV was pulling away. We were all in unmarked vehicles. We didn't have a marked unit to make this traffic stop. I put out that I didn't want any trying to traffic stop there on Tippecanoe because, you know, there's Sam's Club, there's a bunch of shopping centers there, and it was a lot of heavy traffic. And I just did not want to engage in a gun battle with this guy with all these innocent people around.
And that's what you were expecting, a gun battle?
You always expect that stuff. As an officer, you're always anticipating the worst and being prepared for it. So they make that eastbound turn onto San Bernardino Avenue from Tippecanoe. And almost immediately after making that turn, my son, who's in the passenger seat of the vehicle with me, he says, "Dad, there's shots fired, shots fired." And looked at the car, and I could see that the back window of the Expedition was completely blown out. And no offense, but the media was a big hindrance to us that day. They were monitoring our radio channels, and everything we put out over the radio, they were there for. So I hadn't put out any of this over our police radio because I didn't want a media circus to be there if something did happen. Farouk pulls to the south curb of the street, exits his vehicle, and just begins firing indiscriminately at Sergeant Capps. My son Ryan has my AR-15 rifle with him in the passenger seat. He gets out and engages Farouk right away. And then several of my other officers who were behind also get out, and the gun battle basically starts. I start laying rounds down range and firing at Farouk specifically. We move into the front yard of the house on the south side. And Farouk goes down and is basically laying on the ground. I see him bring a leg up and act like he wants to sit up again, fire some more rounds until he's no longer moving. I'm sitting there waiting, and I'm watching to see what's going on, and I can still hear bullets whizzing by me. And I look over at the SUV, and all I can see are hands coming up in the back window with a rifle. And it's Tashfeen just firing indiscriminately out the back window. So then I transitioned to laying rounds down range at the vehicle. We all started basically advancing through the front yards towards the vehicle, trying to get a better angle, trying to get closer. We reach a hedge, and basically it's a skirmish line, and we're firing into this vehicle waiting. Chief comes up and fires some more. We fire some more rounds. Other officers are starting to arrive now, and they're firing into the vehicle as well. And eventually you know, the threat stopped, so we stopped firing, and that was pretty much it.
Today, hand-painted stars hang on the fencing outside the Inland Regional Center. They're called Stars of Hope, and they're sent all around the world from people impacted by disaster to other people impacted by disaster. Julie Paez has one displayed in her home. She also keeps a medal that she was given after the attack.
This is awesome. I'll show you what this is. So when I was in, right after surgery, the nurse, it was a guy, his name was Dexter, and I was pretty much out of it, but he was in the recovery room after the surgery. So these are the things that get me choked up, the nice people. So he runs marathons, and every time he runs a marathon, he saves them for people he comes across. So, say congratulations, Employee of the Year, because I got an award at that day. God bless, keep running. But anyway, it was just so nice. So that's what that's about.
That's good that it's the good things.
It's the good things. The bad things, they've happened. I can't change them, but it's the good things.
Our conversation with Julie Paez in June. We spoke with her today. She had two major surgeries that didn't go as well as hoped back in August. She says she's in pain every day and is struggling to navigate the county's insurance system to get the physical therapy she needs. But she says she remains grateful every day for what she does have and doesn't take it for granted.
And perhaps you've cut the cord, severed that umbilical link between you and a cable box. Well, do you feel that now you need a master's degree to cobble together all the different ways there are to get your favorite shows or live events? Well, let's get a primer with Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic. Eric, hello.
Thanks for having me.
And give us an overarching thought here, and especially for people who are tiptoeing into this. You know, all the different ways you can see something.
Right. What we'll be talking about mostly is streaming. So it's the idea that you would access channels that you would normally see on a cable box, channels like TNT or USA Network or CNN, but you would access them by streaming. You would access them online, displaying them either on your television or on a tablet or on a desktop computer. And there's a few different ways to do that now. You know, obviously you have services like Netflix and Amazon Video and Hulu where you can see select shows. But now we have these companies. One of them is Sling TV that's done by Dish Networks, and one of them is DirecTV Now, which is done by DirecTV and AT&T, where you can get bundles of channels and watch them live and even watch some stuff on demand. And it's all online.
We'll start with DirecTV Now, which launched this week. Do you get everything with it?
No, they have a few different channel packages. What they're doing right now is they have this sort of introductory offer where you pay $35 and you get 100 channels. Now, you can watch these channels live, and some of them offer on-demand programming. So, for example, you could watch CNN as it's happening, or you could call up a grid and decide, hey, you know, I really like that really early start TV show that they have that comes on early in the mornings, but I'm not up at that time. You hit early start, and it will actually play the early start that aired that morning, and it might even play early starts from a couple of days earlier. Some other channels don't have on-demand programming, and it's very hit or miss what they offer, but $35 for 100 channels is a pretty good deal. A Sling TV will charge you more like $40, and you'll get more like 60 channels, but the same sort of thing where you can call up a grid, you can see what's playing live. There's some things that are on demand. You have to sort of experiment with it. And the main thing here is that if you don't want to have a cumbersome cable box or a satellite dish, or say you want to try it for a little bit and then maybe try something else, this gives you a little bit of flexibility.
Talk about that. DirecTV Now, Netflix, don't have you make long commitments.
Exactly. So these services have been controversial in the pay TV world because the way cable works, like cable makes money by making you pay for a bunch of channels that you may not necessarily watch, right? You love ESPN, you love CNN, you don't necessarily care about the Golf Channel, you don't necessarily care about Oprah Winfrey Network, but you pay a blanket fee and you get all these channels. What I think is happening is that people don't want to pay for channels that they don't watch. So if you can go to DirecTV Now or go to Sling TV and see the 10 or two dozen channels that you're most interested in and pay a much lower fee, why wouldn't you do that?
But it's not passive.
It requires a bit of work. I always like to quote my favorite philosopher, Spider-Man, who said that with great power comes great responsibility, right? So consumers have more power than they've ever had before in terms of they got a lot of choice and they've got a lot of control. But everybody's got to figure out like what channels they're into and how do they want to consume them and which service sort of meets that need the best.
Eric Jenkins, NPR's television critic. Eric, I love it. You know, when the great philosopher Spidey makes his way into a segment, it all makes sense.
That's right. Few people realize how wise Spider-Man really is.
Eric, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Next week marks 75 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. A new documentary tells the story of what happened using archival film and radio clips. Joining us now is journalist Tom Jennings, the executive producer of The Lost Tapes, Pearl Harbor, which premieres Sunday night on the Smithsonian Channel. And Tom, a lot of the material you used had never been seen or heard before, right?
Correct. A lot of it has not been seen before, but a lot of pieces have been seen before. And this is a big frustration of mine. For example, the FDR speech, the Day of Infamy speech, which was on December 8th, most people have heard the first 10 seconds of that speech. The speech itself is only just under 5 minutes long. And in this type of show, we're able to play the entire thing. And Roosevelt lays out his reasons for war in ways that most people have never heard. So what we try and do is look beyond what is the iconic moment and see what else is there. And it's almost always surprising, and that's a perfect example.
One of the things that surprised me was some of the anti-war rhetoric and that I don't feel like I've seen before that was happening leading up to the attack, not afterwards, but before. Here's aviator Charles Lindbergh. You have a clip of him speaking 7 months before the attack.
I know I will be severely criticized by the interventionists in America. When I say we should not enter a war unless we have a reasonable chance of winning. War is not inevitable for this country. No one will attempt to fight us here if we arm ourselves as a great nation should be armed.
Now, we look back on that now and say, how could anybody have been against war, especially with what was going on in Europe and the Holocaust? But how much anti-war activism was there at the time?
There was quite a bit, actually, and Charles Lindbergh is a great example. He kind of brought a celebrity face to something that was called the America First movement. And he was one of hundreds of thousands of people in the United States at the time that said, we don't want anything to do with what's going on in Europe. We feel bad about it, but we're going to stay here right at home. And what that did was put President Roosevelt in a very difficult position because he wanted to help, especially Winston Churchill during the Blitz years. He wanted to get involved, but he couldn't. So in our film, you'll also see where Roosevelt is saying, okay, we're not going to get involved, but we will become what he called the arsenal of democracy.
Right.
Which means he's going to, you know, send tanks and send whatever materials they need. But his hands were really tied because he knew if he had to go to Congress and get a declaration of war, he wouldn't get it. So it was a frustrating position. And you see that actually in some of the clips that we have of Roosevelt leading up to the war. And when December 7th happened, he was able to break free of those shackles and not only declare war on Japan, but then enter the war in Europe.
By the way, you never see Roosevelt rolling around in his wheelchair, do you? Even when he in the clip that you show of him giving the speech to Congress, I kept waiting to see him walk down off of the top, but you don't.
No, you don't. And actually, just at the very end, you see where he turns and you can see someone else coming up to help him get off the podium where he is at. And, you know, they made – I've researched this for other films as well. The camera operators back then and journalists made a big point of not filming him in his wheelchair. They kind of protected him at that time. So it's very hard to find moving images, especially of President Roosevelt in his wheelchair.
Another surprise in here was that the first statement from the White House after the attack came a few hours after the bombing, but not from the president. It was made by First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. Let's listen to a clip of that.
For months now, the knowledge that something of this kind might happen has been hanging over our heads. That is all over now, and there is no more uncertainty. We know what we have to face, and we know that we are ready to face it.
The music obviously added by you in the documentary, but you say there's an interesting backstory to the First Lady's address. What is it?
Well, the backstory is that she had a weekly radio broadcast, kind of her version of the fireside chats back in the day of President Roosevelt. And it was on every Sunday night. And the president, upon learning of the attack, immediately went into his office at the White House and started writing what would become the Day of Infamy address. However, that evening, Mrs. Roosevelt had her normal radio broadcast, and she had recorded many of those broadcasts because she was not always available on Sunday evening. She had recorded that broadcast for December 7th, 1941. She went into the studio that evening and went live for the first 4 to 5 minutes of her broadcast, basically delivering to the nation what was happening in Washington, D.C., what was happening with her and her husband, basically telling people it's time to come together as a country and stand up for what has happened, no matter what it takes. So she tagged in a sense, the first 5 minutes of her broadcast live, and then they went back to her basically talking with sailors and soldiers who were stationed overseas about what it was like to be away from home. So it's a very strange mix of we're at war, but here's a feature story about someone who's at sea right now.
One more clip I want to play for you, which is some of the man-on-the-street interviews that were done in 10 cities, including Washington, D.C., the day after the attack. These come from folklorist Alan Lomax. Here's some of what he found.
Were you surprised when you heard the news?
No, I wasn't. I even went as far as to predict last week that Japan would attack first.
My immediate reaction was that the attack had been framed by representatives of governments wishing to draw us into the war.
My first thought was, where were the battleships of the American Navy that we'd been taught for so many years that were scouring the Pacific Ocean and various other oceans for our immediate protection? Where were they?
You know, we call that vox in the radio business, and it's one of the man on the street interviews. We do them occasionally, and they always seem like kind of a pain to do. But I now, after watching this, I think, well, maybe one day they'll be historic. You know, we'll hear how people were. It's so interesting to hear how people thought of what had happened the day after.
I was fascinated by this part of our research and finding Alan Lomax's archive, which these archive pieces have not been heard in, 70 years. He did go out. He sent crews out in 10 different cities to get reaction, because that's what he did. Alan Lomax was a famous folklorist in the United States. And what you hear, I was surprised, I was really surprised by how calm people were and how thoughtful they were. And even, for example, one of the people that you just played where, it's a bit critical of the government. Where were the battleships? Or perhaps this was framed, the conspiracy theorist, this was framed by our government to go to war. But at the same time, in listening to these hours and hours and hours of wonderful man on the street interviews, everyone had a common purpose at the end of the day. It was remarkable how that anti-war sentiment, for example, was nowhere to be found in any of Alan's interviews at the time. It was a remarkable thing, a snapshot, albeit a audio snapshot of what people were feeling one day after the attack.
Did you get any better sense after putting this documentary together about why the Japanese would make such a move and attack the United States?
The best guess I can bring up, based on what we've seen and heard, is that the United States was very concerned that the Japanese were becoming too big a power in the Pacific. They wound up, the U.S. government wound up at the time, cutting off their trade of oil and steel to Japan. And Japan, being an island nation and being cut off from oil and steel imports from the United States, it was only going to be a matter of time before they ran out of fuel and before they ran out of materials that they could build war machines with. And so they felt, in a sense, that if we're going to get ahead of this, we have to strike first.
That's Tom Jennings, who is the executive producer of The Lost Tapes, Pearl Harbor. It premieres Sunday night on the Smithsonian Channel at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Tom, thanks so much.
Jeremy, thank you.
With Donald Trump holding rallies, it feels as if the election isn't over. Well, in Louisiana, it isn't. In that state's Senate race, no candidate won more than 50% of the votes on November 8th. So now the top two are in a runoff election. Republican John Kennedy and the Democrat Foster Campbell will face off on December 10th. Sue Lincoln is with WRKF in Baton Rouge. And Sue, Kennedy, the Republican, got 25% of the vote on November 8th, compared to Foster Campbell's 17.5%. And polls seem to be giving the Republican, Kennedy, the advantage next week as well.
That's absolutely true. The latest poll came out yesterday, and it shows John Kennedy with a 52% inclination of voters to vote for him, 38% for Foster Campbell, and only 10% undecided.
Which could be why Kennedy decided not to do a debate tonight. Pretty safe to say that he's confident in his lead. What does this say about the state? Last year, Louisiana elected a Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards. Foster Campbell's campaign has raised more than $2.5 million, mostly in small donations. Democrats seem to be pouring in resources. It feels as if the Democrats think they might be able to do something there.
Well, they think they could. The problem being is that there is only 10% undecided, and there's a 14-point difference between Kennedy and Campbell in the latest polls. However, the latest poll was a bit skewed. They spoke with 71% white potential voters, 24% black. Our population here is 65% white and 35% black. So that gives a 9% advantage with the African Americans, who do tend to vote more Democratic here in Louisiana. In addition, there was a skew of about 7% on gender. This poll questioned more females, and in particular more white females, than the population shows. However, it was only a poll of 500 likely voters.
Well, we were wondering if there might be a skewing effect as well, because John Kennedy is the Republican, but that's a traditional Democratic name, if people are unfamiliar with the race and just voting by names. But also, there's a twist. There's a new TV ad from the Super PAC Defend Louisiana, which supports the Democrat, Foster Campbell, and accuses the Republican, John Kennedy, of defending the right to choose abortion. Let's listen.
While Foster Campbell voted with us to protect the unborn, John Kennedy worked with Planned Parenthood to defeat pro-life legislation.
How is that going over in this, you know, somewhat conservative state?
We're not really seeing an effect from the commercial just yet. However, John Kennedy was indeed a Democrat before he became a Republican. He changed parties in 2007.
Well, we should say, even if the Democrat Foster Campbell wins, the Republicans still hold the majority in the Senate. But it would be pretty symbolic for Democrats, considering the outcome at the very top of the ballot. How much does Donald Trump's win affect this race?
It affects it a lot. John Kennedy has indeed hitched his star to the Trump campaign, and Foster Campbell has been, shall we say, making nice, saying he will work with President-elect Trump as he can, but there are some things on which he stands absolutely. So we'll see how voters go with it. It also depends on how voters turn out. Right now, we're in early voting, and turnout has been about 50% below what it was for the November 8th election. Mm-hmm. So that may have an effect, because right now, who is voting in early voting are older voters, chronic voters, and primarily Republicans.
Yeah. Well, Sue Lincoln, you're there in Louisiana. Obviously, people thinking about the Senate race, but while we have you, they're thinking about a lot more. There was that terrible incident of apparent road rage in New Orleans yesterday. The former NFL player and hometown hero, Joe McKnight, shot and killed. But there where you are in Baton Rouge, terrible shooting incident recently in response to a domestic violence situation.
Absolutely. We had a situation here where a man shot his longtime girlfriend, pushed her out of the car. When first responders arrived, the man came back and tried to run over the first responders, succeeded in one particular case, shot at them, shot at sheriff's deputies, and ended up being killed himself. So it was quite traumatic. That happened Sunday night.
Yeah. Well, and one of those first responders died. So lots on the minds of people there in Louisiana. And you remind us that both of the candidates in the Senate race are pro-gun. You kind of have to be in your state.
Absolutely. You have to be pro-Second Amendment here. However, John Kennedy has received the endorsement of the NRA. How that will play in response to the shooting problems that we've had both here in Baton Rouge and in New Orleans recently remains to be seen.
Sue Lincoln of WRKF in Baton Rouge, thank you.
You're very welcome, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.